Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
G'day, you legends. I'm Daniel Thomas. Welcome to Supercharge Mojo. Thank you so much for tuning into the show. This is my conversation with Nathaniel Turner. He has such a unique spin on parenting. He's tried and tested his own philosophies, his own, call it a parenting model. I hope you enjoy this one, guys. Let's get into it.
What led you to where you are now, and are there any significant personal challenges that stand out to you that you had to overcome?
My origin story. I'm from a small, I would say a medium-sized city it's in the U.S., and it's called Gary, Indiana. The city, people know it who know it or don't know it, they know Michael Jackson, and Michael Jackson and the Jackson family are from the same city that I'm from.
Ah, okay.
The city that I'm from also during the 80s, late 80s, early 90s was considered the murder capital of the world and perhaps the most violent city in America. So there's that. That's, I guess, two sides of the place that I'm from. It's also the city where the very first African-American was a mayor. So the city is quite interesting in that regard. And I was born in 1965. So at the, during the period of the civil rights struggle, city having its first Black mayor, entertainers coming from that place. And today it was a steel city. And so a lot of blue collar worker. So I guess some of my mentality is developed from that origin.
Yeah, interesting. It's quite a mix of stuff there, like you say, within the town. Did you experience any of that violence, the rougher side of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because sometimes when you live in a place that the outsiders see as a violent place or a crime laden place, because those things are common to you, it's just where you live. Mm. And you don't necessarily know that where you live is different because you've never been anywhere else. Like the very first time I ever got on a border to airplane to leave the city, I was 17. Mm. So, for the first 17 years of my life, Gary was all I knew. So if it was violent, it was, people fought and people shot at each other and stuff like that, but it was home. So I didn't know anywhere else. And so, if you're poor, you don't know that you're poor until you go somewhere else and you realize, oh no, this is different. Like my mother dropped me off at college. I didn't visit the university that I was going to attend. And Gary's also at the time was the most segregated city in America. So it was 97% of the city is African American. And so when I attended the university, it only had 3%. No, I shouldn't even say it was 3%. there were 38 students of color out of 3,000 students. Wow.
So it flips. So,
absolutely. And I'm like, whoa, this is some, right? One of these things is not like the other, but you don't know that anything is different because, you know, you've only experienced one thing.
Well, what did you go to study?
I went to study accounting. So I did, and I got a degree in accounting. So that's an interesting story. But yeah, I went to go to college because that's what I was told that I needed to do. I really didn't know what I was going to do. I knew that I had to go to college.
Mm, yeah, like, which is often the case. Yeah, I know that as well. So you have this interesting perspective of designing a life template. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. So because my life is as I described it, I would say my life is a lot of luck, some preparation, but a lot of luck. I met people, luckily, who cared about me for no reason. I met people who loved me and wanted the best for me for no reason. And, you know, Seneca says luck is where opportunity and preparation meet. I think I was prepared a lot less. I was prepared a lot less than I needed to be, but because people were willing to afford me opportunity, then things were better for me than a lot of my peers. When I was realizing I was going to be a parent, I was in law school and did not have any job opportunities available to me at the time. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was told, hey, if you're not in the top 5% of your class, you know, you're not going to have a lot of job offers, et cetera. And so it sort of dawned on me at that moment, I'm about to have a child. Now I've made it to law school and that's great. But if I had been at a school like a Harvard or Yale or Princeton or, I would have a lot more opportunities because I wouldn't have to graduate in the top 5%. People would come look for me because I graduated from those schools. And so I decided to write Harvard and get an application for an unborn child. And the long story short is that application then became the template we would use to raise our child.
Oh, wow.
And then a template that we use and share with other families about things that they can do with their children.
Interesting. So the letter was for your own child in future.
Yeah. So I got an application. I wrote on Harvard, asked Harvard, because this is 1994. So in 1994, there was no online presence. You couldn't just go online and click a button to get an application. You had to, I don't know how old you are, but there was, you'd look in a magazine and you'd tear it off and sometimes it'd be self-posted. Yeah. And you write your address and they would mail you back an application. So we got the application and noticed in the application, there were three things that Harvard wanted. One, they wanted students, of course, who did well academically. The second thing they wanted students who, as they said, were world citizens. This was in 1994. And the third thing they said, they were looking for students who cared for something greater than themselves.
Mm.
And so we use that as the model for designing our child's life, that if we could make it so that when our child was our age, he wasn't having to worry about if he was at a good enough school or she was at a good enough school, that they were having to worry about how they were going to get a job. Two, we wanted to make sure they were world citizens at the time. That was, can we make sure they could at least speak another language? And the third thing was, can we raise somebody who cares about something other than themselves? And so everything we did for that unborn child to today, that child's 28, has been guided by those three principles.
Excuse me. Yeah, they're really awesome fundamental principles, as opposed to, you know, tick X number of boxes, just those three solid foundations. That's a really cool thing to take that and use that as like call it the piers of a foundation for your child's mm-hmm. future
mm-hmm.
as a person, not just as a, you know, as somebody trying to further themselves in this world. Excuse me.
Sure.
Yeah, so that became your kind of guiding principle.
Yeah, so today we don't look at it from the academic standpoint as much. We call it intellectual ambition. So today we say, hey, we'd love for children to do well academically, but doing well academically is an outcome-oriented goal. What's the process for that? Well, the process for that is to make sure people, for example, learn how to think critically. The process for that is to make sure a child can learn to read as soon as possible. The process for that is to help children have an appreciation for, and maybe even a love for, math and science. And so if we can do those things, then the academic outcomes are liable to happen. The second element, which was raising someone who was a world citizen, today we call that global and cultural competency. Well, the world is really big, but the world is really small. And you are in Germany and I am in the US, and you and I are able to have a conversation because of some form of technology. Well, how do we help children so that when they meet people from other places, they know enough about those other people in those other places to be respectful and appreciative of what's different, but also the things that are similar? And then the last part was just how do we raise someone who's focus in their life is to leave the planet better than it was when they arrived. How do we raise someone to be humanitarian? So those the guiding principles. And what we've realized in that, where there were three things that we should do. One, we should expose young people, children, to as much as possible. So in a world where people sometimes say someone's a jack of all trades and master of none, we think that's cool. That the more stuff you know about, the more stuff in some ways, that's great. Then there's also some things that we believe that everyone should know. So we would want children to know math and science and read and write and respect for other people and humanity. Those things we want them to do. And then the last thing we ask families to do is to ask yourself, if today were your last day, how is it that you want to be remembered? What do you want us to say about you? And it is in the eulogy, what we want you to say about you in an obituary. What is it that your last will and testaments or the things that are scribed on your tombstone would say? And those things become how we go about building that temple.
Mm. It may sound cliche, but yeah, parenting is a real game changer. I know firsthand, I have a son, and he holds a mirror up to me constantly. He's made me question my own values. He's made me question the system that he is in and how I navigate that. But ultimately, it comes down to the time that I have with him, and he is watching my every move and how I influence him with not only the things that I do, but the things that I expose him to, the lessons that I try and give him. So I just know firsthand what a game changer it was for me becoming a father. And I think it's so awesome that you have taken this as the way forward in how we raise our kids. And I've been tussling a little bit lately. He's just started high school, and I've had some frustration with, I mean, my fiance is a teacher, so we have these discussions. She's doing an amazing progressive job with her kids, but generally some of the stuff I see in schools and the systems of things I tussle with, and then I try and bring it back to, okay, well, that's the school, but how can I have my influence on him as best I can? And I think you've said yourself that rather than get frustrated with the systems, it's about the humans. It was actually nice for me to read that earlier, because in the past week I have been having a little bit of frustration with the system, and I don't want to be like, I'm like, well, what can I do within my family and within my community so that I don't just get a little bit bitter about the flaws I see in these systems.
Well, you and I share the similarity. My son's mother, or my wife, is also an educator, and so the high school experience was a little bit turbulent because I see the world very differently than I believe most educators see the world, and I was not afraid of sharing that the way I saw the world was much more accurate than the way that they saw the world. So I do understand what could be frustrating. I would say that. I would imagine. Yeah.
To me, it's just, you know, the individuality. How does the education system nurture when kids and are just so individual that it's very hard to throw them all in the same spot and not allow for the differences. And also from my own experiences through school, it's like, it's a tough one, but I'm confident in the influence that I have on my child. But those guiding principles you're talking about, they're very cool in terms of having a broader perspective outside of the little world they're in.
Yeah, I remember talking to my son's high school teachers, like at the parent. I don't know if they do. I'm sure they do that in Germany.
Yeah, the
teacher conferences. And I would take a minute when I could to express to them that my child was not like everybody's child, which I would assume that nobody's children were all the same. And one of the things I say this all the time, I've yet, even to this day, to ever meet a teacher who ever asked me what my hopes and dreams were for my child. Mm. And I would say to them, I said, this is flawed because the child is mine. And if he ends up in a jumpsuit, an orange jumpsuit that says State Pen, or if he ends up turning the tassel and have a doctor's hood, either way, people are going to hold me responsible for that. And so I would say to them, like, stop trying to pretend like I don't exist and what I want for my child doesn't matter. And so
some discomfort.
Some of the teachers understood that. Some of them
understood that. Awesome.
Some of them didn't. But today, my son holds a PhD in electrical and computer engineering from one of the top schools in the world. That would take Carnegie Mellon University. And he's working on an MBA now. And as I mentioned earlier, when I was in Germany because he was playing soccer or football. Nah. And he was playing, and he had tryouts in Germany, in Nuremberg. So now I have the proof that I was right. So when they were, hey, this just seems ridiculous. Yeah, okay. All right, whatever you say, but we're going to do it this way because at the end of the day, I'm the person that's going to be responsible for it. So I would say whatever it is that you believe is in your child's best interest, it's probably in your child's best interest, unless you're talking about something really obnoxious. But generally, the education does lump all kids together and makes some assumptions about all kids being identical. And I sort of get that. I mean, you've got a classroom with 30 people. You probably don't have a lot of time and energy to be trying to differentiate child after child, but the children are different. And we should have a conversation with the parents and find out what they hope, what their hopes and dreams are for their children.
I clashed with a teacher a little bit here because one of the kids was heading off on his family were taking him on a kind of world trip in a way, but they were doing it like in a van and stuff, and they were like going to Italy and all this, and she was very much like, this is going to disrupt his education. He should stay in the village. And I was like, no, his eyes are getting open to other cultures, to the world. It's as opposed to him sitting there with 1980s printouts of maths that with no, you know. And another thing you've said, which I think is cool, is about the focusing on the who as opposed to the why.
Yes.
The why in a different context in terms of school is often the why is not there, is in why, like I remember, why am I studying Pythagoras? I had no idea. I had no interest. Mm-hmm. But if somebody had said to me, maths is like a language of the universe, and you know, but it was just, no, learn Pythagoras. And I was like, this is, there was no why to it.
When am I ever going to use this?
I mean, I just think like school, if school was like basic budgeting, well-being, stuff like that, but you know, it's a tricky thing. But this who versus why, you're referring mm-hmm. to that it more in terms of the growth of the individual.
Yeah. So here there's there's a gentleman by the name of Simon Sinek who's quite famous, and Simon Sinek is famous. I wouldn't say he's only famous for this, but the thing that people probably first initially recognized him for, he did a speech about great leaders begin and end with why. And it is the case in America. I won't speak for other places, but it is the case in America. When people hear something, they take the parts of what they heard and everybody starts to use it. So everywhere you'd go, people would say, do you know what's your why? What's your why? What's your why? And I'm like, well, that seems to be the wrong question to ask, because my why today won't be my why tomorrow. If you ask me, why do I work? And you asked me that 30 years ago, I tell you, well, I work because I have a wife and she expects me to work, and I have a child I'm going to have a child one day, and I have to be able to take care of my children. If you ask me today why I work, I don't work because my wife needs me to work, and I don't work because my child needs me to work. I work because maybe I care about my clients, or I enjoy what it is that I do, or it's a respective vocation, but my why has certainly changed. So I said, well, what should we be focused on? We should be focused on who, and then who by in terms of who we want to be when our time is up. I had a very good friend who died in 2008, and I went to his funeral, and on his tomb there were two words inscribed, and one said author and poet. And I thought, well, who knew he was that? Like, is who decided that that's who he was? Well, at the end of our lives, somebody else decides who we were. And the only way we get to influence who we are when we are no more is by knowing who we are when we are here.
When we're here. Yeah.
And so I said, well, that feels like something I should be focused on my who as opposed to my why.
Yeah, interesting. It's a different approach. And what you said at the start of our conversation, just about opportunity and luck and sort of what you're born into, a lot of kids are born into circumstances where they're merely surviving, and they just, what I've kind of observed, they just don't actually have the space to even kind of pursue much else, because they're so busy just surviving day by day, because they're in crisis families or whatever it may be. But it does make you ponder in terms of parents preparing to have kids, but what would you say to them?
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Well, as you said earlier, something about parenting, I think parenting requires a lot of hubris. I think any of us who decide to be parents, especially if we, like, if I could go back now, and I'd say to myself, dude, you are not even close to being prepared to be a parent, because I've had the benefit of, like, being a parent now for 28 years. And again, in the U.S., folks are commonly say, well, you know, there's no book and there's no manual, to which I would say, well, then create your own book and create your own manual. So that's the very first thing I would say to parents. What is it that you want for this unborn child? Like, let's imagine, let's be audacious, let's dream. But what is it that you want to happen for this child's life? When this child turns 18, what do you want to happen? I decided, right, that when my child graduated from high school, I wanted my child to at the very least meet the academic qualifications of a school like Harvard. So I at least knew that I wanted that. And then I wanted my child to be a humanitarian, and I wanted my child to have a global perspective of the world. That's what I want. But most of the time when I talk to parents, they haven't thought at all about what they want for their children. They say, well, I want my child to be happy. Well, okay, well, what does that mean? Right? I want my child to be well-adjusted. Well, what does that mean? So I would say what parents need to do is have some concrete benchmarks for what it is that they want to happen for their child. And then so thereby work backward. The second thing I would say is parents have to take a very good look at themselves, because a lot of who we are manifests itself in the children that we bear. And unless we, you know who we are, I mean, we're very likely to cause damage to children because we haven't taken the time to figure that out. And then thirdly, whoever it is that we're going to have children with, assuming we're having children with someone, the question then I would ask, is that a relationship that's sustainable? And so we talk a lot about sustainability of the planet, you know, the air, the water, et cetera, fuel sources, et cetera. But we don't talk about sustainability in terms of humanity. Well, can Daniel and Nate coexist and raise a child if Daniel and Nate no longer care for each other? Can Daniel and Nate set aside whatever problems Daniel and Nate have so that they can raise a child that can be intellectually ambitious, globally and culturally competent, and humanitarian driven? And if Daniel and Nate don't think they can do that, then maybe Daniel and Nate, when Nate and LaTanya in my case, say, then we shouldn't have a child. Because once you invite somebody somewhere, then you owe them the best of you. At least that's the way I look at it.
That's also, it's just like a good, hard, honest check-in about it. It's like not dancing around the edge. It's like the reality of it, especially the sustainability thing. It's not a common I just don't think it's done. I mean,
no, it's defying our comments.
Somebody was saying to me recently that there should be a parent license, you know, you need the license and stuff. And I was like, oh, this is potentially bordering on some controversy. But I don't know, I just think in the lessons that the way I try and influence my son, and an example that just springs to mind is we used to play this card game when he was small, and he kept cheating at the card game, right? He kept, and he would win. And then I was like, all right, how am I going to, you know, there's a few approaches I could have taken. I could have punished him, you know, got it, you know, been angry about him and stopped the game. But the approach I took was, you're welcome to continue to cheat. And when you win and you cheat, try and examine a little bit how that feels. And if you feel great about it and you feel like you've genuinely like achieved something, go ahead. But if there's something in you that says I've won, but I don't feel quite right about it, maybe think about that. And then he stopped cheating from that point on. So I'm not saying I'm not saying I'm the perfect father. I just try to come at it with a, sometimes with a different a different approach. And I just try and listen. I try and listen and also get to the underlying things. Like there might be something that's kind of on the surface, but what's the real frustration, and let allow him to be heard, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's it's a unique, but very insightful. And what seems also under the surface is, and you're probably not going to say this because I suspect that this is the humility in you, that you and his mother had provided him with a certain level of value system that when you could ask him that question, he could answer the question by not cheating any longer.
Yeah.
So he already knew that what he was doing wasn't great. He just needed you to ask him the question. You didn't have to give him the answer. You just had to ask him the question. So that says to me that you have laid a foundation for him. That's a uniquely good foundation that you just nearly needed to ask the question, and he answered the question to the test and passed it.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, like, I used to seek driving time, like car time, because unfortunately we have a bit of driving time. Well, it's not unfortunate anymore because I used to get frustrated with the driving time. I was like, we're just stuck in the car. There's not much. But I actually realized the thing about driving is there's nothing that you can actually really do except like talk to one another, which in this day and age with all the distraction, everything, it was like, I realized it was a chance to talk to him about anything that was going on. And then I realized how ideally I don't want to be in the car, stuck on the motorway in the car, but I realized in time that was actually a really good opportunity to hear when I grabbed him from school, to hear him out about whatever was on his mind. And then when we got home, we could get into the games or homework or whatever he needed to do. So I guess finding that kind of space to listen and allow the kids to be heard is pretty important too.
Yeah, you found the silver lining in a situation that you didn't quite. Yeah, that's cool though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kind of reframe. It's a tradition on the show to have guests offer listeners a challenge of some sort, given their experience. Not to put you on the spot, but is there something that springs to mind, particularly relative to parenting, I guess?
Well, we talked about a little bit about who, so I guess what I would ask your listeners to do is to, it's not an analogy, but I'm going to explain who this way, and I'd like them to then answer this for themselves. Okay. So it goes like this. You are not who you think you are. You are not who you believe others think you are. You are only who those you are in a relationship with know you to be. So I'll explain it. If you ask me, Daniel, what kind of father I am, I would say to you, Daniel, come on, man. I'm the greatest father in the history of the world. And then you say, well, what does your son think? And I say, I'm pretty sure my son thinks I'm the greatest father in the history of the world. And then you say, well, can I talk to your son and ask him myself? And you talk to my son, you say, and he says, no, man, he's not. I don't even like that guy. Who am I? Am I the guy who believes himself to be the greatest father in the world? Am I the guy who believes his child thinks he's the greatest father in the world? Or am I a mediocre father because the child says that's who I am? And I think that is a question we should all ask ourselves in that layer with anyone we have a relationship with. We should actually ask people, who am I? Like, who am I? If you have a child, as an example, I've done this with my son. I said, write my obituary. I want you to write my obituary because you probably will. And I want to know right now who you think I am. And because if I find out that who you think I am is not who I want to be, then now is the time for me to correct that. So
That's all. Yeah. There's a certain amount of courage in that as well. Like even not only family, but anyone who's close to you to ask that question, what is your perception of me? I've asked that a few times, and you're right. If it's out of alignment, with your values and what you think you're, yeah, it might be time to have some course correction. But like you say, if you're just caught in your own perception and you're not getting any alternative views, you're right. It might just be not what you think.
Yeah. And if you don't care about anybody, then it doesn't matter. I guess it won't matter to you what anyone else's opinion of you is. But if you love and adore people, and those people love and adore you back, well, you might want to know if I am who I believe I am. And if I'm not, I want to correct that. I want my son to see me in a very positive light. And if he says to me, "Man, you're not who you profess to be," well, that means it's time for me. More than anybody on the planet, I feel responsible for being better because of him. I would say to my wife, "Well, you married me," and which is a little bit different just because yours is voluntary. But this child we had, he didn't volunteer to be here. We invited him to be here. And for that reason, I feel more responsible to be the best possible person I can be for him than I do for anybody else on the planet.
Mm. Yeah, very cool. And I think some of the courage, some of the fear is often when you're asking people who genuinely care about you, like it's going to be constructive. And often the fears I've had when I've asked for honest opinions about stuff, particularly creatively, it hasn't played out as scary as I've believed. People do come from a place of compassion, you know. It's not like the Wild West of the internet where they just smash you on a comment or whatever. When it's people who are genuinely, you have these close relationships with, but it takes some courage to step into the discomfort of that.
Well, those people are invested in you too. So I get it. Right? I do get the fearfulness initially, but then the other part of me is that they're invested in you. And if the old adage is true that birds of a feather flock together, if you're around eagles and eagles have embraced you, eagles want you to fly. And so if eagles see that your wings are not moving in right fast enough, or you're not spreading your wings out far enough, well, eagles should tell you, "Hey, we want you to be an eagle. So here's what you need to do differently." And I would imagine if a baby eagle, when they get tossed out the nest, I would imagine a baby eagle would not be offended if the other eagle said, "Hey, you better learn how to fly. You're going to crash on this concrete pretty soon."
Yeah.
But I guess we can lose sight of that the people who do care about us, whose opinion we do value and care about, 9 times out of 10, I would probably say 99 times out of 100, they're not going to say anything that's harmful to us. They're going to say things, even if it sounds constructively or if it sounds critical, there's probably still going to be some grains of constructiveness inside them.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. No, that's very cool. Where can people find you?
The easiest place is, I have a website and we're updating that now, but the address will still be the same as Nathaniel A. Turner. So NathanielA, like you spell Daniel, AturnerCom. That's the easiest place.
And so are you writing on that site and things? What sort of stuff have you got on there, resources?
So I used to have a blog called Raising Superman, which I see your Superman in the background, right? But I call it Raising Supaman because I didn't want to get sued by the folks at DC Comics. So I did write all the time there. I have not written on the blog now, probably in a little over a year, but there's probably 300 or 400 things that are still there. So it's still linked to the site. Most recently, over the last couple of years, what I've been doing, I've been writing, sharing a journal. So each day I wake up, I write it. I spend the first 20 minutes of each day writing my life how I would like it to be as opposed to how it is. And it's actually a lesson that I learned from a child. Like, I used to ask my son when he was running track and playing soccer to write how he expected the match to go or how his track meet would go. And I would, you know, the whole idea behind visualization and manifesting. And so I met a group of students one day and they asked me if I did that. And I said, well, like all great hypocrites, I said, no, I don't do it all what I've been asking my son to do. And so I started to do it. And so now I do that in the first 20 minutes of each day. So you'll find on the new site, you'll find some of those journals that I write each morning. And we also have an audio version of it now. And so I published a book a couple of years ago that was a collection of journals with action and reflection statements of a friend who's a pastor. And she said to me, you know, these things kind of remind me of this thing that she reads called the Daily Bread. And she says, you ought to give some reflections and some action items. And I said, I'm not going to do any of that. But you feel free, if you like to, you can write those. And so she did. And so we published the first book with 55 of those entries. But in the future, what you'll find on the site is a couple times a week, I'll share some of the journals that I write. And then there's an audio version of it as well.
Yeah, cool. The little journals, are they based on the day ahead or are there a bigger overview of stuff you're working toward?
So there are... I'll send you one from example for today. But generally what I do is just a stream of consciousness. I wake up and I try not to talk to anybody or read anything. And I get out the bed, brush my teeth. Today I went and sat on the balcony and I just set the timer on my laptop for 20 minutes. And I just write whatever comes to my mind. Today I wrote about Humpty Dumpty. I woke up this morning. I was thinking about Humpty Dumpty. And him having a big fall and all the king's horses and all the king's men can put Humpty Dumpty back together. And I was like, well, what does that mean? But why am I getting that today? And so I wrote a journal entry about what it means for you to fall and realize that nobody can put you back together, that you have to figure it out yourself. So sometimes I write about things that I want to do. I may have, you mentioned about being in Australia. Again, I heard one of your posts, your podcast, and about a beach. So some mornings I wake up, and while I don't live in California, I write about as if I live in California. There's this house I imagine living in, and there's this little dog I imagine owning. And each day, this dog and I named Journey. We go for a walk, and we talk to neighbors. And so, yeah, it could be any number of things, but it's usually stream of consciousness, and for 20 minutes, and I write, and then I edit it because I can't share with people grammar stuff problems, but then that's the end of it.
It's pretty cool that you allow what needs to come through to come through, because we're conduits for stuff and things come at strange times. And it's like you can fight that or put it on paper, but then to share that as well is because you're right, like you might be compelled to write about something that feels out of left field, like Humpty Dumpty, but then out of that comes comes a little reflection about what's the message of that, you know?
I did not intend to share it with anyone. A friend asked me, hey, you seem different, what are you doing? And I said, well, you know, I read some stuff about the brain having this reticular activating system and us having 60,000 to 70,000 thoughts every day, and 90% of our thoughts are the same thoughts. And one way to change that is to wake up and start right and have new thoughts. And I thought, okay, well, I'll wake up and I'll just write sort of emotively and imaginatively about what I would like if my life could be exactly what I wanted to be. So some days I'd written about, hey, I want to go speak in front of an audience with at least 10,000 people. And oddly enough, Daniel, like 12 to 18 months after writing that entry, someone called me and asked me to come speak in front of 11,000 people. I'm like, hey, I want to just one day hop on a plane and fly to Hawaii. And one day I just hopped on a plane and took the family with wife. So I was like, wow, this manifesting thing, this kind of working. So I probably should keep doing it. It's working out for me. So I've just continued to do it now. I've done it now for probably 5 years, probably got, I don't know, close to 1,600 entries or so.
That's awesome. That's very cool. I know what you're saying. Like, and it's not even like airy fairy stuff. Like, it's like a defrag for the hard drive. You know, it's like resetting that process, overloading processing side of our brain. And yeah, I was doing some similar stuff for a while and some things started to happen. And I think I got a bit, scared because I was like, holy shit, this is kind of working.
Right. So we quit, like we always do. When it works, we quit.
And I kind of retreated, you know? So that's really cool. I'd love to read some entries.
I'll send you some. And then you're in Australia. I was like, I'd be happy to send you the book, but I know I can send you the link. I can have a thing called book to look, and it's a link, and you can read it's not Kindle, but the whatever it's called, the virtual copies of the book.
The ebook stuff. Yep. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure, Nate.
It's been my pleasure. Anything I can ever do for you, please feel free to reach out to me. Good luck and best wishes with you and your son.
Yeah, likewise.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.